country and Western countries increasing political pressure on Iran to unprecedented levels.
We are here to say that we are proud of our revolution and our country.
When Imam Khomeini needed our support to topple the Pahlavi regime, my sons did not hesitate.
I am here to say that I will always support the leader and the Islamic revolution.
My son gave his life for this revolution, and I am here to uphold his values.
Iranians are celebrating the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution at a time when they've managed to thwart foreign-backed riots in the country and bring peace and calm back to all the cities across Iran. More than anything, the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution is a show of solidarity. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
The decision to send German and American tanks to Ukraine is continuing to generate controversy. Many believe the move will prolong the war, and there's concern as to how Russia might respond. However, at a parliamentary hearing on Tuesday, EU legislators were told the West should go even further.
Russia is attacking Ukraine from Russian territory, so obviously we should provide the Ukrainians with long-range missiles, obviously.
There are a lot of EU lawmakers who agree.
Any delay to supply Ukraine with needed weaponry and ammunition is more lives lost on the battlefield.
Some argue constantly supplying lethal weapons to Ukraine is foolish.
We're prepared to risk nuclear war in order to continue this US-NATO proxy war. It is total madness. And this European Union and the European Parliament have lost the plot. They've lost the run of themselves.
European Union taxpayers have provided 50 billion euro to Kiev since last March.
What happens to all the money we send to Ukraine? Is it just disappearing into individuals' pockets? Even President Zelensky has had to admit there's a big problem with widespread corruption.
A number of legislators would like to see less division within the EU.
Austria and Hungary just decided we will not deliver weapons. Okay, it's their decision. But that shows already some hesitation or some breakup of unity.
Spanish MEP Javier Nart told his colleagues it's, quote, ridiculous to suggest Ukraine can win the war against Russia. For now, the US and Germany have ruled out providing fighter jets to Ukraine. Others, including France, have not. According to many analysts, the risk that the conflict could escalate further and spiral completely out of control has never been greater. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin visited South Korea this week to reassure officials here that Washington will remain committed to the U.S.-South Korea alliance.
The U.S. commitment to the defense of Korea is ironclad. You heard us say that a number of times, but that's just not a slogan. It is what we're all about. That commitment is ironclad. And our extended deterrence is at the heart of that commitment.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol restarted large-scale joint military exercises with the U.S. last year, although the U.S. reportedly deployed its so-called strategic assets, weapons capable of delivering nuclear bombs. The South Korean leader wants more American firepower at his disposal. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has repeatedly suggested the need for the U.S. to make a stronger demonstration of extended deterrence, its nuclear umbrella. And the South Korean public has grown skeptical of the U.S. alliance, with a majority now advocating that South Korea develop its own nuclear weapons. The U.S. has also pressured South Korea for greater cooperation with Japan in participation in joint drills. Peace advocates find such a trilateral alliance worrisome.
If the South Korea-U.S. and South Korea-U.S.-Japan alliances are established through cooperative military exercises, the South Korean military will now defend Japan and the U.S. mainland in the Pacific, not South Korea. South Korea will then be reduced to an outpost to protect the United States and Japan.
Meanwhile, earlier this week, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg visited South Korea to encourage Seoul to send weapons directly to Ukraine. South Korea is exporting weapons to countries that are sending their own military supplies to Ukraine, but has so far refused to provide Kiev with direct military aid. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In a new decree by the Ministry of Higher Education, the Taliban government ordered universities and private institutions in Afghanistan not to enroll women in the entrance exam of 2023. While this decree strengthens a December decree that totally banned women from education, women feel frustrated about their future educations.
When I first heard that we can't enroll for the entrance exam and saw the decree, I felt frustrated. I had high hopes for my future. I feel terrible about that.
I felt like my life had come to an end when I heard this. To be alive is not just to breathe. One must reach their dreams. I felt deeply sorry and not alive.
While the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, with 57 members of Muslim countries, has called the new decree disappointing, Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, in a press conference expressed his country's readiness to provide any kind of support to Afghanistan in order to restore women's education in the country. Iranian universities had already announced their readiness to hold online classes for the women of Afghanistan. The women in Afghanistan say such a cooperation could be useful.
Once again, we stress that banning girls and women of Afghanistan from education is an improper act and against Islamic teachings. Iran is ready to offer any kind of support needed to upgrade education and reopen schools for the women of Afghanistan, in coordination with the interim Afghan government.
Meantime, Afghan women say international community has turned a blind eye to their problems.
Unfortunately, whatever happens in Afghanistan, the international community just condemns it. Online education, on the other hand, is definitely positive, but not as much as face-to-face classes. We women ask the international community to negotiate with the Taliban on reopening the schools.
Education ban in Afghanistan started 500 days ago on girls in 7th to 12th grade, then a ban on universities 2 months ago, and following that, women were banned from working for foreign NGOs and organizations that caused many of these NGOs to stop their mission in Afghanistan. Now, a ban on entrance exam and the question, is there going to be more such restrictions? In both decrees on women's education ban, a line draws attention saying, until further notice. But nobody really knows if and when this ban will end. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
Nadeem Zahawi, the Conservative Party chairman, fallen from grace for not paying his taxes. He received accolades as vaccine minister during the pandemic and even ran for prime minister last year. His downfall began after it emerged he settled nearly a $6 million dispute with the UK's tax collector, HMRC, during his time as Chancellor last summer. An inquiry ordered by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak found Zahawi had breached the ministerial code.
Zahawi is out, but now the focus has shifted to the Prime Minister himself. This week, he'll be facing tough questions in the building behind me about how much he knew about Mr. Zahawi's tax affairs and when.
Zahawi's sacking has also acted as a reminder about Rishi Sunak's reinstatement of Suella Braverman as Home Secretary last year, after she resigned for breaching the ministerial code by sending a sensitive official document from her personal email account.
Sunak has said he wanted to have a government of integrity, essentially, and it sends the wrong signals in that sense too. We therefore see a government which is drifting and failing to achieve some of its own specific targets. And that's got to be a worry for the Prime Minister and indeed for their election chances.
Speaking of Boris Johnson, he's been named by his supporters as a potential candidate to replace Nadeem Zahawi.
He's seen as a vote magnet, but he's also a trouble magnet. Most recently, we've seen these questions being asked about the chair of the BBC helping him out with a loan. Nothing has been said about law-breaking, but with all of the other problems the Conservatives have, do they really want to risk Boris Johnson in a position where he could bring more intrigue, let's say?
That, in addition to a parliamentary inquiry into whether Boris Johnson misled the House of Commons over Partygate, lockdown rule-breaking drinking sessions during the pandemic, and an investigation into numerous complaints of bullying by Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab. Nadeem Zahawi will be remembered as the minister who played fast and loose with the rules and became the first one to be dismissed by the Prime Minister. But no one's sure if he will be the last. Saeed Purizep, London.
Tensions between Muslims and Hindus in Britain have risen following the recent release of a new BBC documentary which explores the rise in Hindu extremist politics in India and concerns that India's Prime Minister may be facilitating the increased violence against India's religious minorities. Over the weekend, British Hindu protesters condemned the BBC with a series of demonstrations outside their UK offices. In one case, a British Muslim of Kashmiri descent confronted a group of Modi supporters in Birmingham.
Modi is a terrorist! Modi, that's it! Keep it moving, guys! I love BJP!
Some clashes turned violent, as was seen in Australia, this time between Modi supporters and local Sikhs. The two-part documentary, India, the Modi Question, has not been broadcast in India by the BBC. Despite this, India's federal government banned the film, citing emergency powers under India's controversial information technology laws. An attempt by Indian students to air the program on Friday in New Delhi led to scuffles and arrests.
Where is our freedom to express? Here we students are not supposed to watch a documentary. If it is hidden, if it is banned, then sure there might be something important in it.
Here in Britain, local activists have expressed concern over the possible spread of the same Hindu supremacist ideology to UK shores.
It's a double standard. When they cry for help, they're seen as the victim. But when we cry for help, we're seen as the aggressors. And the simple fact of the matter is that the extremist Hindu community here in Birmingham, it has been growing in UK, has been growing for some years.
In 2022, two English Midland cities witnessed street clashes between Hindus and Muslims, with locals complaining that the troubles in India had essentially spread via the Indian diaspora to British shores. This new documentary has clearly opened old wounds, which could be traced back to 2002, during the notorious Gujarat pogroms, which left approximately 1,000 Muslims killed. Robert Carter, London.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The Israeli regime has recently stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians in every way possible. It has been raiding towns, demolishing homes, and murdering people at an increasingly alarming rate. Despite all these crimes, the international community remains silent as Tel Aviv expands its illegal settlements. Certain Arab countries, most recently Sudan, are establishing relations with the Israeli regime, a move that Palestinians say betrays their cause and emboldens the occupiers to continue with their crimes. We're going to discuss that with our guests tonight in our Spotlight program. Joining us, we have Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nim, who's joining us from Ramallah. Also, we have human rights activist Mohsen Naqvi joining us from Houston, Texas. Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Professor Nimr in Ramallah. Well, defying international calls and outcry, Israel has approved plans to build about 1,200 more settler units in occupied Al-Quds. Under international law, we know that all Israeli settlements are illegal, and the Israeli judicial system has no legal authority over the population that it occupies. Human Rights Watch has time and again said these policies amount to apartheid and crimes against humanity. Why are these policies continuing then?
Well, this is the policy of this regime, this colonial regime. This is their policy. The whole idea for the Israelis is to ethnically cleanse Palestine, and particularly to starting with to ethnically cleanse Jerusalem. You know that we have more than 22,000 houses already served with orders to be demolished in Jerusalem. And at the same time, they are building more and more settlements. The whole idea came up after the year 2000 when they started this plan called 2020. In 20 years from 2020 to reduce the number of Palestinians who were at that time around 40% of the population in Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, to bring them down to 12%. Accordingly, they have to demolish houses, take the citizenship from the Palestinians, cleansing them out, and not giving any permits to build houses, and at the same time, annexing more settlements and building more settlements and enlarging existing settlements by adding new units. Now, we are talking about around 800,000 settlers in the West Bank, including Jerusalem. The new plan now in 2025 to make the settlers to reach 1 million settlers in the West Bank and Jerusalem. Accordingly, they are building more and more in the settlement, in spite of the international law, which stated clearly that this is against the international law and against Geneva Convention, and at the same time against also human rights, because they are, moving the Palestinian out and bringing in more settlements and settlers. I'll give you one example. For instance, in the Jabal Abu Ghneim, or as they call it, Har Huma, a settlement there, the capacity for building for the settlers is 120% per land, meaning that they are going into high even buildings. While in the same area near to Jabal Abu Ghneim, the Palestinian area, the building their capacity, they are giving the Palestinians only 40%. So if you have a land, only on 40% of it you can build. But in the settlements, they built 120%. So it's quite clear that they are trying to cleanse the Palestinians out and increase the number of the settlers in Jerusalem.
Mohsen Naqvi, what are the Israelis achieving with this land grab policy? Apart from their efforts of Judaization of Palestinian land, are the Israelis also deliberately sabotaging any prospects of future Palestinian statehood?
Certainly, there's absolutely no doubt that this is the wish of the Israeli, the Zionist regime, that they believe and they think, and I think it's the strategy has failed, and it is not a viable strategy for them to make more colonies and make more settlements. Because if they believe and feel that by bringing in more settlers and by expanding their colony, if that will solidify their position in the West Bank or the Al-Quds or Jerusalem area, they are absolutely mistaken. This is a mistake. This is a strategic mistake that they are making. And the reason why I say that this is a strategic mistake is because their very existence on that land is absolutely unnatural. They have nothing to do with that land. They have absolutely no affiliation with that land whatsoever. And so their very existence on that land is unnatural. By bringing in Jews from Europe, by bringing in Jews from different parts of the world, from the U.S., for instance, and settling them in Palestine will not in any way ensure their existence on that land. That's one thing. Secondly, with these expansions and with these colonies, these so-called colonies that they're creating, they're giving the world one message. And the message is that the resistance has been right from the get-go. Israel never wanted a two-state solution. They are, the Zionist regime is telling the world that they do not want a viable solution to Palestine, that they do not respect international law, that they do not respect the Geneva Convention. They don't believe, they don't respect any kind of compromise or law. And this is exactly why the resistance movements have been screaming out loud to the entire world that a two-state solution is not viable, it is unfair, and it can never happen because the Zionist regime doesn't want a two-state solution. The Zionist regime wants to keep expanding its colonies. It wants to create more colonies and bring in more settlers from different parts of the world, but it is not working. It is clearly not working. Very soon, within the next 10, 15 years, we'll see that these same settlers who they're making colonies for will be going back to where they came from because they will not be able to withstand the pressure that the resistance forces will unleash on them. They're already failing right now. The Zionist regime is on the verge of becoming a failed state.
All right, Professor Nim, on Thursday, Israel and Sudan said they'd finalized a deal to normalize relations during a visit by the Israeli foreign minister to Khartoum. Give us your views on this move by Sudan. Palestinians have repeatedly slammed these normalization deals between Arab states and the Israeli regime as a stab in the back. In your opinion, have these Arab governments turned a blind eye to the suffering of the Palestinian people?
Well, we are discussing here two issues or two separate kinds of normalization. The one kind, which like, you know, Emirates and Morocco and Bahrain did, and they are not under such a pressure. The pressure is only the American pressure, which is a normal pressure in this case, and they are willing to go, you know, ahead with this normalization with Israel. But in the case of Sudan, which is a little bit different, Sudan, you know, even before the revolution that happened a few years ago or 2 years ago, what was marked by the Americans as a terrorist regime. And in order to get out of this marking as a terrorist regime, apparently the deal was you have to normalize relationship with Israel. Otherwise, yani, why? We can't even imagine why the Sudanese will do such a thing. But the military government there, they were under such a pressure by the Americans, and they apparently complied with this pressure to normalize relationship with Israel. Now, the foreign minister of Israel being visiting Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, and having this kind of, you know, normal relation in order to sign the agreement, what would the Sudanese get out of this, you know, deal? Or nor even the Israeli, from the Israeli point of view, it's, you know, they are trying to set the fact that normalization with all the Arab countries first before they even think about talking to the Palestinians. And once they have normal relationship with all the Arabs, then forget about the Palestinians. From our side, as Palestinians, we think that all these kind of normal normalization and agreements under the pretension or under the name of Abraham Accords are absolutely a stabbing in the back of the Palestinians, and these Arabs are letting go of the Palestinian cause, and they are not committed at all to any kind of you know, relationship with the Palestinians in such case, because they are, you know, going ahead directly to have this kind of peace relationship with our enemy in the region. And it's quite clear that the American pressure started since the Trump administration, and now it's continuing. Netanyahu's new government, after he was elected just a few weeks ago, he said, I'm not going to talk about the Palestinian question. I'm not going even to discuss the Palestinian question, but rather we are going to focus on more Arab countries to normalize the relationship with Israel. And he said that we are very close of some of Gulf states, countries that they will join the Accord, Abraham Accord, and we will focus on that matter. So it's quite clear that he's saying that he's not going to look at the Palestinian question, while his government, especially with this Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and this fascist government now in Israel, are going ahead with a full steam atrocities against the Palestinians. Ben-Gvir now started with the prisons, now the prisons in a form of a kind of a revolution, and we are expecting now a huge kind and a big hunger strike in all the prisons. He's attacking the villages and grabbing more land, settlements, enlarging settlements, and he was the one behind the El Khan El Ahmar in sure. Jericho area, yes, in order to demolish it, but now they postpone it till June. But they are doing all the things, and Smotrich, he confiscated the Palestinian money, and okay. They are going ahead, and Netanyahu is not concerned with all that at all.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mohsen Avni, Hamas has strongly condemned Sudan for finalizing this deal, saying the normalization would in fact embolden Israel to continue its racist crimes against Palestinians. Are these normalization deals in a way a green light for the Israelis to continue their day-to-day crimes and brutal killings of Palestinians?
You see, I think there are two aspects to this question. The first aspect is that it is not the people of Sudan. It is not the people of the Arab world. It is the governments of the of these countries
sure.
that are promoting these normalization efforts. And also, they've been trying to test their people for so long now. They've been trying to take a feel of what if Arab Muslim society or Sudanese society, how will they react to the normalization efforts? And this has been going on since the past 10, 15 years. And I can tell you for a fact that the very reason why the arrogant powers of the world selectively place governments that are either monarchies or dictatorships is so that they can easily control them. It is very tough to control a democratic government that has been chosen by the people because, trust me, the will of the people, the kind of attachment that the people, that the Muslims of the world have with Al-Quds, it is not that simple to have these normalization efforts succeed. If anything, these dictatorships, these monarchies are threatened from within their people, that if these normalization efforts are successful and they do, there's a huge chance that there will be a coup within these nations. Now, when Hamas criticizes these countries, they're obviously criticizing the governments. The governments are clearly making a mistake, and the reason why they're making these mistakes is because the U.S., the arrogant powers of the world, have confined them within debts. They've confined them militarily. They are in debt to the World Bank, and the way they operate is that we'll compromise and get rid of a certain loan only if you normalize efforts with Israel. That's how they function. But it's very tough for them to pull this off. I'll give you the example of Pakistan. As soon as the people of Pakistan smelled that the new government of Imran Khan or the establishment of Pakistan is tilting towards normalizing relationships with Israel, there were protests all over Pakistan. I'm originally from Pakistan, so I can say this for a fact. There were protests all over Pakistan. There were riots all over Pakistan. So the sentiment that the Muslims have towards Palestine is more than just an ethnical or a nationalistic inclination. It's a very religious inclination that we have towards Al-Quds, towards Masjid al-Aqsa. So it won't be as easy as they're making it sound. Yeah, this is obviously one of their dreams, that, and this is one of their efforts, that efforts are normalized. Because then they think if efforts are normalized, then within the Arab world, the resistance movement will not be able to spread as it is spreading right now. But with the success of Hezbollah, with the success of Hamas, with the success of Islamic Jihad, there are other factions in Bahrain, there are factions within Saudi Arabia who are also taking inspiration and influence from these successes. And I think it is practically impossible for these normalization efforts to succeed because of those reasons.
Sure. Professor Nimr, as we've seen in the past, there's been a lot of opposition from the people of these countries, as Mohsen Aghvi just alluded to as well. They disapprove of these deals. They aren't happy at all with them. So what are these governments gaining in return for these normalization deals? And basically, is it worth it, taking into consideration that these deals might one day backfire?
Well, yes, I think so. And I do agree with your guest who said that the pressure coming from America and the money pressure and from the World Bank and other issues that the Americans have against this dictatorship. But for the people, it's definitely another story. In Morocco, there were many demonstrations in Morocco against the normalization. And in Morocco, we have a very strong kind of a BDS movement and a support to the Palestinian among the people themselves. And we saw that also clearly in the World Cup. Also in Bahrain, there were demonstrations and people were against this normalization, and they clearly make the statement that they are not going to approve this kind of normalization apart from the regime itself. So definitely we are talking about regimes from one hand and people on the other hand. Now, if you come to Emirates, first of all, there is no people. We are talking about a government with only 17% of the population. And I'm quite sure that if we ask these people in Emirates also, they are against this normalization. People will get nothing out of this normalization. Governments, they make their position with America much better, and they think that the only way to win the heart of the Americans is by normalizing with Israel. So they think that that will be the benefit for them, to give them access to more money from the World Bank, or to get them out of this list of blacklist, or American blacklist, or any other kind of, and this is only for the dictatorships in themselves and for the regimes, not for the people. And we believe that, yeah, sooner or later, the people will say their word, and they will go against their governments in such cases. Even when we talk about in Jordan or even in Egypt, who had for many years the normalization with Israel, there is no real normalization. After more than 30 years of peace process between Egypt and or even 40 years between Egypt and Israel, the Egyptian people themselves are still against Israel, and they resent, as Israel expected, a big kind of tourism coming to Israel from Egypt, or they will accept Israelis in Egypt normally. No, it's still the relationship still among the people themselves is really different. It's only between the dictatorship and the regime and the Israelis. And we believe that sooner or later, people will say their word, and they will go against these regimes, and they will pay the price for what they did to the Palestinians.
Right. Mohsen Aghvi, what about the United States here and Israel? In many accounts, do you believe that they're trying to legitimize the occupation? If Arab governments are normalizing ties with Israel and they aren't prioritizing the Palestinian cause for the region, then it's easier to get other countries to downplay it as well. Is that what's being done here, in your opinion?
Well, that's what they're trying to do. The relationship between U.S. and Israel, it's a it's a close relationship, but it's also a very sensitive relationship. And the reason why I say that is that Zionists control so much of the United States. May that be the weapons industry, may that be the media industry, this may that be the property industry. There's so much that the Zionists control within the U.S. that it's almost as if the Israelis, the Zionist regime, or their representatives, they run the U.S. The lobbyists that we see that work and who work on behalf of the Zionist regime within the U.S. are so strong. I mean, we all know about Jeffrey Epstein and the kind of influence and the kind of pull he had on these government officials. May that be Elon Musk, Bill Gates. Name any billionaire within the U.S. because, as we all know, that the U.S. establishment are its billionaires. The U.S. establishment are its company. This is the military empire that controls the U.S. in general. And unfortunately, the Zionist regime has a huge grip, a very strong grip on U.S. politics because of the kind of pull they have financially. Now, as far as the people of the United States is concerned, especially the people who support the Republican Party, who have a slightly religious inclination, they do wonder and they do think that we talk about free medical within the U.S. We don't have money for medical care. We don't have money for free education. But we have money, the billions of dollars that are paid towards the Zionist regime. The American people are now wondering for what reason, for what influence, as the U.S. empire is becoming weaker and weaker in the Middle East, and as the U.S. empire is moving more towards electricity and is moving towards oil, their interest within the subcontinent, within the Middle East, is slowly decreasing. And their use for the Zionist regime is also decreasing with that. So there's this huge disparity within the U.S. establishment right now. And as we can all see, that there are government officials as of now who are giving statements against the actions of Ben-Gavir, who are giving statements against the actions of the new far-right Netanyahu government. There's a reason for that. We haven't seen the U.S. government be critical of the Zionist regime. I mean, the parties, the opposition within Israel is also supported and funded by the U.S. and the U.K. So we've never seen this before in the past, that there are voices within Israel right now who are speaking out against the current government. So there is this huge disparity that we see. There's this huge difference. And I believe that as soon as the U.S. realizes that the Zionist regime was a mistake, and as soon as the U.S. pulls out its influence and its support to the Zionist regime will crumble and fall.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests, Professor Saad Nimr, joining us from Ramallah, and also thanks to human rights activist Mohsen Aghvi, joining us from Houston, Texas. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Islamic Revolution and Economic Achievements. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, these days mark the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. In order to have a proper picture of the economic achievements of the Islamic Revolution, we should have a look at the waning days of the Pahlavi rule in Iran. During the Shah regime, Iran's economy was excessively dependent on oil exports. Millions of oil barrels were exported every day, while a huge amount of consumer goods worth hundreds of millions of dollars were imported to the country. During the last decade of the Shah reign, oil price enjoyed an unprecedented rise so that in 1977, the oil revenues reached over $20 billion, whereas this number never amounted to $1 billion in the decade before. American writer Francis Fitzgerald wrote that the Shah did not make serious effort for the development of the country. The country's wealth had been funneled mostly toward personal cars rather than buses, consumer goods rather than public health, and the salaries of soldiers and police rather than teachers. It can be said on the economy of 1970s in Iran that the regime's programs destroyed the economic balance of the country due to being far from the realities of society. As the Iranian economy was highly dependent on oil, the 1976-78 reduction of oil prices caused the government to borrow money, which in turn resulted in a bunch of problems, such as the shortage of skillful manpower, shortage of communicative networks like roads and ports, shortage of electricity, escape of capitals from the country, inflation, unemployment, housing, and so on. Unjust distribution of income in rural and urban regions and different strata of people caused remarkable class gap in society. Andrew Duncan, author of the book Looting Iran, Assault Towards Money, says that Iran's economy highly suffered from the ambitious and unwise plans of the Shah and his lack of information in the Iranian society. He writes that the Shah thought that money can solve every problem. He summoned the members of his cabinet on one day in August 1974 and announced that he wanted to double the 1973-78 development program. It meant to increase it from $35.5 billion to $86.8 billion. Although there were few specialists to implement such a huge plan, it would make no difference for the Shah. He would announce, for instance, that all children should go to school while forgetting that it needed at least 30,000 teachers. The Shah Prime Minister Hoveida said in response to this great shortage, "No problem, we will teach all via TV." He had forgotten that over 65,000 villagers had no power grid at all. The victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution in February 1979 revived hopes in the hearts of people. In spite of unprecedented pressures of enemies to obstruct or at least slow down the move of the revolution towards lofty ideals, including the 8-year imposed war, innumerable conspiracies inside and outside the country, and also imposition of the cruelest illegal sanctions on every aspect of the country's economy, The Islamic Republic has marched proudly in the course of growth and development. Justice enjoys a very outstanding position in Islam. According to the Quran, the aim of mission of all prophets has been to establish justice in society. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says that cities and countries will not be developed except by justice. In view of this, among the most important goals of the officials in three branches of governance has been to provide welfare for people and provide them justice in various economic fields. Before the revolution, few villages enjoyed electricity, hygiene, water, natural gas, and telephone. This was common even among small cities and towns. Less than 12% of the rural areas had access to water grid, while this figure has surpassed 82%. There was 0 kilometer of water transferring line before the revolution, whereas the figure has reached almost 31 kilometers after the revolution. Qadir project in Khuzestan province has recently been exploited. The project is said to be the greatest in West Asia, and it will transfer drinking water to 26 cities and over 1,600 villages. The project has been implemented by Khatam al-Anbiya Construction Base, whose young experts have managed to finish the project within 8 months, while it was predicted to end in 36 months. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been successful in the field of dam construction. The number of dams in the country has increased tenfold compared with the pre-revolution era. In other words, nearly 200 dams have been built in Iran by a skillful young specialist. Dams are useful in various domains, including the production of hydroelectric energy. Iran is among the 10 top nations in the construction of power plants. This has caused 100% of the population in the cities and approximately 99.6% of the rural people to enjoy electricity. This, while the average electricity access among villages and cities in the world is 79 and 96% respectively. Another success in Iran in the field of energy is the construction of petrochemical factories and refineries. Over 70% of Iran's energy consumption relies on natural gas. Currently, more than 98% of cities and 84% of villages are connected to the natural gas grid. There are nearly 2,000 active oil companies in the country. Before the revolution, the major part of this industry was run by foreign firms, but today Iranian experts have succeeded to indigenize 80% of the equipment needed in the field. The great bulk of this equipment is high-tech. 50 of the manufacturing companies are in the international rank and export some of their products, like catalysts, to Russia. Iran seriously tries to increase the number of petrochemical factories and refineries to prevent crude sale. Today, the number of active petrochemical complexes has increased to 68, more than tenfold the period before the revolution. Between 90 to 100 million liters of gasoline is averagely produced every day in the country. This includes 27% of Iran's refinery basket, which is higher than the global average.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.